From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, Michigan's members of Congress weigh in on President Trump's budget. The Republican view:
this budget, by almost every standard, is a non-starter.
And Democrat:
this budget will not pass. Even conservative economists say it's unrealistic.
Plus, wind turbines wear out their welcome in Huron County.
There's something called turbine fatigue and turbine saturation, and I think we're at or near that point in Michigan's thumb.
And a couple of 19th century scam artists hawking biblical era relics in Michigan.
It says more about what people knew from reading the Bible and going to church than they did about archaeology.
Those stories and more, but first, the news. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Are the winds of energy change stalling out in the Great Lakes State? And does mixing alcohol with name-brand energy drinks increase risky behavior? We'll speak with a researcher later this hour. But first, President Trump's very first budget is getting an icy reception on Capitol Hill from both sides of the aisle. With us now, Republican Congressman Fred Upton of Southwest Michigan. Welcome. What is your take on President Trump's budget?
Well, I got to say, it's really not very realistic. I was disappointed when it came out. They know, and I know the governor weighed in. I know our whole delegation weighed in, not only from Michigan, but around the Great Lakes, to make sure that the Great Lakes initiative, not a heck of a lot of money relative to the, in the scheme of things, but, you know, it's so important that we have that $300 million for clean water, for fighting the Asian carp, other invasive species. I mean, we've made wonderful progress, and to eliminate this program, it's just not a starter. You know, the other big issue that I've focused on is health research for the National Institutes of Health, the NIH. Of course, it was our bipartisan bill that President Obama signed that really led the charge to see a $45 billion increase over 10 years above the baseline for the NIH. This budget that came up cuts it by $5 billion. That's just not acceptable. And if you want us to ultimately get to a 3% growth rate, and I think everybody does, you have to invest in the future. And what happened over the last number of years is that, particularly on the medical research side, we were not seeing innovative new products to find the cures for all these diseases done here in this country. By a 50% margin, that investment went overseas, Singapore, China, Australia, Ireland, Israel. And one of the things that we did with our cures legislation is we said we got to expedite the approval of drugs and devices here. And I got to tell you, you know, as I was at Michigan and Michigan State and, you know, other Western Michigan med school, great promising research is being done. And this investment is not only saves lives and saves money. No, Medicare is going to spend $1 trillion on Alzheimer's by the year 2050. Anything less than that we spend is a savings. But to cut back dramatically things like the NIH means you're not investing in the future, and that's not a good thing. So this budget, by almost every standard, is a non-starter. And this is Republicans and Democrats saying it.
And we also hear concern on both sides of the aisle regarding the cuts in safety net programs. I mean, the very voters that put President Trump in the White House, people living often paycheck to paycheck, are really going to get hurt by these. What did you think as you saw the scope of that?
Well, that's true. But you also have to remember that unlike what happens here in Michigan with the state budget, this budget is only a request. It actually never does get to the president's desk for either a signature or a veto. It's just a recommendation. And because the many in the Trump team, including the cabinet, you know, here it is almost June. This budget is months later than it normally comes up. It's really, I don't think, going to be relevant in the process as we embark on getting spending priorities for fiscal year 18, which starts October 1st.
And we know this budget relies on the idea that our nation's economy will grow at this annual rate of at least 3%. As you say, that's desirable, but that's almost double the country's 1.6% growth in 2016. And we haven't seen a pace like that in some two decades. I'm wondering, in your view, how much should a budget rely on projected economic growth to make it all work?
Well, this is what you call the rosy scenario. 3% growth, we all want it. And frankly, we have to have it. As we work on getting the $20 trillion national debt down and ultimately a balanced budget, you have to rely on growth. You know, in all expectations, no one's expecting to see this in the next year or two, but you've got to lay the framework so that ultimately you can get there. And that's why tax reform on a bipartisan basis is so important, and that signal has to be sent really in the next couple of weeks, particularly to the business community and others across the country, that we are going to compete. We are going to compete with the rest of the world. And one of those things means that we're not going to have the highest corporate tax rate that there is in the world.
What economic growth number would you support?
I'd like 3, 4, 5%. But you got to invest in the future to be able to get to that number. 3% sounds pretty good right now, since it's only about 1.5%. But ultimately, I'd like to do better than that. But I know in the short term, we probably can't get there.
Will you wait for a score from the Congressional Budget Office before voting on that final budget?
The Budget Committee hasn't even started. But yeah, the CBO will score whatever the Budget Committee does. But they've really not even, I'm not on the Budget Committee, they've had a couple of discussions. I don't know that they've had a formal hearing yet. That won't start for a few more weeks.
Voters in Michigan helped to put Donald Trump in the White House. Overall, how do you feel that they've been treated by this first budget of his?
Well, a couple things. You know, we all want a balanced budget. We all want to pay down the debt to get there. We know that, you know, the budget, it's thousands of items. There is never a time that we can't find a thing or two that we object to. But for us in Michigan, it just wasn't very good as it relates to the Great Lakes, which we all care about. We really do. I mean, people that don't even live on the Great Lakes know the importance of what this is for our region. And, you know, as you look at, you know, particularly some of the what you call the social safety net programs, those programs for the most vulnerable, whether it be working families trying to make sure that they have insurance, health insurance for their kids, roads and bridges, all those different things, those are priorities that we as a Congress need to work on, and on a bipartisan basis. And this budget proposal, as it came out, really doesn't help us get to where we're going to finish very much.
St. Joseph Republican Congressman Fred Upton, thank you so much for speaking with us.
You bet.
With us now, Democratic Congressman Sander Levin of Royal Oak. Congressman, you have served in the House since 1983, so you've seen a lot of budgets. How does this budget compare to what you've seen in your time on the Hill?
This is the most pernicious. It's based on false assumptions, and it would result in domestic cuts that would hurt families, both middle-class and low-income families, throughout Michigan and throughout Macomb and Oakland County, which I represent in part. It's based on some false assumptions that tax cuts pay for themselves, an economic growth assumption that even conservative economists say is unrealistic. And then it combines those two false premises with, as I said, domestic cuts of all kinds.
Yeah, I'm curious what hit you the hardest as you looked at that budget, what you feel are the biggest problems that budget could mean for people in Michigan.
Well, for example, cutting the mental health research budget by $5 billion or so is a frightful mistake. That's just one example. There are others, for example, eliminating the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative. That's also a mistake. There are 764 projects in Michigan to clean up major areas of concern, and some of those are in Macomb and Oakland County. That's a frightful mistake. It would also cut the community development block grants, which have been really important for residents in Oakland and Macomb County, for example, rehabilitation of homes, weatherization, senior home services, job training cuts. Those are the opposite of what we need when there are people who need more training. not best.
Congressman, there have been so many reports about how the base of the Democratic Party has been urging lawmakers to resist everything President Trump wants to do. Given that pressure and the Russia investigation swirling around the Trump administration, are there items in the budget where you feel like you could find compromise or at least some common ground with your Republican colleagues? I mean, the Great Lakes Initiative, a restoration initiative, certainly is one area among the Michigan delegation. But are there other areas?
I think some Republicans oppose this budget. John McCain said it was dead on arrival. And the problem with this budget is it's so extreme and it hurts families right where it counts the most. So I don't see any basis for support of this budget. And it's not because of pressure from one part or another of the Democratic Party or any party. It's the issues, the programs themselves, the notion that essentially we leave everybody on their own, that can't work, or leave it to the counties or the states. You can't do a Great Lakes restoration based simply on counties. You can't do that in terms of health research. Medicaid, I didn't mention, they would cut an additional $600 billion from the $800 billion or $700 billion already would be cut under the Republican health program. And then cutting programs for the disabled by $72 billion, that hurts people from virtually every income bracket.
Well, let me flip this around. Do you feel that, given what we heard, for example, I talked to Congressman Fred Upton, who feels that this is a non-starter budget. So maybe the flip side of this is, do you feel that there is common ground with your Republican colleagues to join together to block this areas of this budget?
Yes. I mean, this budget will not pass. But the real issue is going to be whether we can combine to support programs that need to be supported. Food stamps is an example. I mentioned a number of these. And the question will be whether the Republicans will join with us and not succumb to pressure from parts of the Republican Party, including the head of the budget office who proposed this, or pressure from the administration. Sure, we hope we can find some common ground. They have to be sure that they're not going to crumble when there's pressure, when we look for common ground.
Democratic Congressman Sander Levin of Royal Oak. Congressman, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thanks so much.
Coming up, new research into mixing alcohol with energy drinks and risk-prone behavior. It's revealing the psychological effect of mass marketing. And the Michigan History Center shares the story of the mysterious Michigan relics. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Energy drinks are omnipresent on college campuses, and so is alcohol. So what can happen when the two are mixed together? That's what Aradhana Krishna explored in new research into alcohol mixed with energy drinks. She is the Dwight F. Benton Professor of Marketing at the Ross School of Business at the University of Michigan. Pleasure to have you back on Stateside.
Oh, thank you, Cynthia.
So what questions were you looking to explore and answer with this study?
There's been a lot of research which has already been done on alcohol mixed with energy drinks. At one point, it was believed that energy drinks mask the effect of alcohol because energy drinks have a lot of caffeine. So when people drink energy drinks mixed with alcohol, they don't feel intoxicated. So the belief was that even though people were intoxicated, they were not feeling intoxicated because of the caffeine in the energy drinks, and that these people who were intoxicated but not feeling the effects would then become more sexually aggressive and more likely to have drunk driving accidents. But then later on, this theory was found to be incorrect because people found that there was not enough caffeine in the energy drinks to have this masking hypothesis. Yet, despite that fact, people kept finding that people who were consuming energy drinks were, in fact, being sexually more aggressive and being more risk-prone in their behaviors. So the question was, what is driving these effects? What is behind energy drinks mixed with alcohol causing these very sociably undesirable risk-prone behaviors? So that's what we were trying to look at.
And why did you think that was so important? What pointed you in this direction?
So what pointed us in this direction is the very very high number of college students who, like, people are saying that more than 50% of college campus students are consuming alcohol mixed with energy drinks. And from surveys in college campuses, it is also well known that people who are drinking alcohol mixed with energy drinks are risk prone. So we started thinking, is there something else which is going on here? And then there was also this case against Red Bull, where there was a class action suit against Red Bull saying Red Bull does not give wings, so it's false advertising. And they looked at physiological effects. So does Red Bull really make people, let's say, smarter or physically better? And they found that that's not the case. So they lost the class action suit and a lot of money. But then all these studies, what we found, that the one thing that was missing was not physiological effects so much as psychological effects. So can energy drinks mixed with alcohol have psychological effects on consumers? So it's clearly got very, very big effects for college students and for public policy and for food policy institutes. But even from a more theoretical perspective, we found that it was interesting because people had not looked at psychological effects over here.
Being a professor of marketing, this is exactly what you look at.
That's, exactly, yeah, what we look at. So we were wondering whether advertising could have created expectancies and whether these expectancies could in turn be creating placebo effects. Let me elaborate. So what I'm saying is, so for example, Red Bull could be saying Red Bull gives you wings, or Monster can say unleash the monster in you. And so what these drinks tend to make college students think is that they somehow become more powerful, or they feel that if they mix it with alcohol, the alcohol becomes more potent. So that's the expectancy. So what we did was we did a study in Paris. And the reason we did it in Paris is also interesting. So there's a backstory to that. We know that college students have alcohol. They're not supposed to. They are under 21, but we know they have it. We wanted to actually do the experiment in the most realistic scenario possible. So we wanted to do it with college students. So we cannot get IRB approval for that within the US because we cannot give alcohol to students who are under 21. And again, we didn't want to give people drinks which were not alcoholic, but call it alcohol. So we wanted it as realistic as possible. So we did it in Paris, where alcohol is allowed below the age of 21. And so there we recruited males who, and we were very careful about following American procedures in terms of who we recruit. And these are people who are not, you know, in any sort of risk of alcohol-prone tendencies. So we did all the screening. And then we got males of the same BMI so that we could control for BMI. And then we gave all of them the same drink, which is vodka mixed with Red Bull mixed with fruit juice. And we gave them, let's say, the amount of alcohol which you would have with one daiquiri or one tequila.
Okay.
Then there were three groups of students, and one group was given the name of the alcohol was Red Bull Vodka Cocktail. A second group was given the name Vodka Cocktail, and the third group was called Cocktail Exotique. The only difference was in the name, but every group knew exactly what the drink contained. So they knew it contained alcohol and Red Bull and a fruit juice, which again replicates a bar situation where you know what your drink contains, but the bartender has complete flexibility in naming it whatever he wants.
So it was the name that was important.
It's just the name.
Yes.
And then we were trying to see if just the name can lead to different levels of perceived intoxication. So the actual intoxication would be the same. It's the same amount of alcohol, and we measure blood alcohol content, and we in fact found that it was the same. But then if people are asked, how drunk are you feeling, we found that they felt more drunk when the cocktail was named Red Bull Vodka Cocktail.
So it was that name. It was injecting the name Red Bull that made the difference, not the alcohol.
Exactly. So it was injecting the name Red Bull that made the difference. And then we looked at behaviors and attitudes. For example, we measured financial risk taking. Financial risk taking was measured by a balloon task. So in this task, people are made to pump a balloon on the computer. So they are made to pump a balloon. And if the balloon becomes bigger, you get a certain amount of money, and you can put another pump and make it even bigger. But then if it bursts, you lose all your money. So if you're more risk prone, you will put in more pumps into that balloon. We were counting the number of pumps that they were putting in, and again, we found that people who were given the drink, which was named Red Bull Vodka Cocktail, were more financially risk seeking. They were also more sexually self-confident, which meant that when we showed them pictures of like 15 women, and five of them were, you know, pre-tested to be considered very attractive, and we asked them, would you hit on them, and do you think they would give you their phone number, they seemed to be more confident that they would get the phone number of this person and also be more likely to hit on them.
And again, these are the guys that were drinking the Red Bull and vodka drink. They had the Red
Bull. So these were the people who were, they were given exactly the same drink as the others, but the name of the cocktail that they were given was Red Bull vodka cocktail.
So we're talking marketing. Why is this, do you think?
We also measured people's beliefs on how much do they believe that energy drinks increase the potency of alcohol. And we also measured their beliefs on how much does being drunk make people more risk-prone, for example. And we found that it was these expectancies which were driving behavior, which means that people who believe to a larger extent that energy drinks make you more intoxicated are the people who feel more intoxicated and are more likely to have those risk-prone behaviors, which is actually really interesting because from a public policy standpoint, what we are trying to say is so far the policies have been looking at physiological effects. And what we are saying is they should be looking at psychological effects. What they should be focusing on is, should companies be able to advertise in a manner that creates these expectancies from the drinks? And people should be much more careful about that sort of advertising.
That takeaway then, controlling the marketing message related to these energy drinks. What more questions now has this raised for you?
Broadly speaking, you know, it's a bigger issue conceptually in the sense of what kind of placebo effects can there be? So this is a marketing placebo effect. It's just the naming. This opens up a whole slew of questions up there, like what other kinds of placebo effects can marketing stimuli create? What are the other kinds of things that people should be looking at, which could be psychological drivers of behavior and not just physiological drivers? So again, from a public policy perspective, what can people be looking at?
Aradhana Krishnan is marketing professor at the Ross School of Business, and her research on alcohol, her study on alcohol mixed with energy drinks, can be found in the Journal of Consumer Psychology. Thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, thank you.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty.
I, Gerald R. Ford, do grant.
The other passengers very reluctantly gave up their seats, but I refused.
The young man makes up his mind to work. There's no limit to what he can do.
This is truly the next chapter in General Motors recovery and turnaround.
You're living at a time of extremism, a time of revolution.
Ancient relics from the Mediterranean found across Michigan? Well, that was the headline turning heads at the turn of the last century. It is Wednesday, and that means it's time to talk our state's history with our partners from the Michigan History Center. Here now is Eric Perkins, historian at the Michigan History Center. Eric, we've got a pretty interesting story here with some twists and turns. So let's start at the very beginning. What were these relics and who found them?
Right. The Michigan relics were originally found in October 1890. A man named Scottford was digging post holes near Wyman in Montcalm County, and he came across some mysterious artifacts during his dig, at least that's what he said, and he interested the townspeople in these things, actually brought some out to help them find some of their own, and created quite a buzz and quite a stir in the town.
Now, what kind of artifacts? What was it that he said, look what I found?
Some clay artifacts, I think it was a cup, and maybe some small copper things. Most of the early finds of these were clay. And he actually got them so excited about it that they formed the Montcalm County Archaeological Trust with the idea that they would go and find these relics, basically corner the market on them, and really catching on to the buzz that was around the World's Columbian Exhibition that was coming up in a couple of years. But initially, we're thankful that this Montcalm, one of the trustees of this Montcalm Archaeological Trust actually went and said, you know, maybe we better check these things out. And they actually ran them by a couple experts, including an expert on Middle Eastern languages and some archaeologists who pronounced them immediately to be frauds. So they dissolved that trust. But the story didn't go away, and these things keep popping up. In 1898, a man shows up at the University of Michigan Museum and offers the curator a box full of these clay artifacts and various things for sale. When the curator laughs at him, he drops the price. And
there's a tell.
and the guy's exactly. And so the curator says, you know, you're dealing in frauds here. You need to stop doing that. And the guy says, well, can I leave them here while I go, you know, I don't know, feed the meter or go home and check out a story.
Scuttle anyway, off.
So that's how the U of M got their small collection of these pieces. But the story doesn't go away.
Believers are going to believe, aren't they?
Believers will believe. It becomes such a craze, if you will, because the things keep turning up, that in 1907, a Detroit news reporter gets a hold of it, a guy named William Benscoter. And in the great tradition of investigative reporting, he digs and digs, and he goes and he finds the guys who are now in the Detroit area, and he grills these guys. And the one actually says, eventually kind of sort of partially cracks. No one ever confesses to making these, but he says something like, who are you to interfere with a private enterprise?
Meaning, who are you to stop me from making money?
Exactly. And so what they would do, they would stage these finds, and they would get respectable folks from these small towns to come out and, quote unquote, find the pieces that they planted in the ground and sign an affidavit that, hey, we found this mysterious artifact in the ground. And then they would create the buzz around it. But eventually, they had enough of a buzz going on that they just turned most of their efforts to just cranking these things out. In fact, the reporter Benscoter refers to it as a mill, you know, the mill.
The mill.
Yeah.
And by then, the former Michigan Secretary of State, Daniel Soper, was involved in all of this?
Right. Soper comes on the scene, and the thing becomes really about promoting these for sale to collectors. And Soper becomes a very vigorous defender and countering. Whenever experts will pronounce them as frauds, he counters them in the most colorful language he can get away with.
And we should note he had to resign as Secretary of State for corrupt behavior.
He did. He was a disgraced former Secretary of State. Later on, he moves down south and starts calling himself a senator. Yeah, so his story, you know, his checkered career, but there are interested parties. The LDS Church becomes interested in them.
Latter-day Saints, okay.
Latter-day Saints, also a clergyman named Father Savage in the Detroit area, starts a large collection of these things. And so, you know, they're seriously interested in these pieces because a lot of times they employ biblical imagery in the pieces. And so it's really sparked a lot of interest that way. And it says more about what people knew from reading the Bible and going to church than they did about archaeology, which was just a budding science, really.
Yeah. Did it go beyond some, the initial things that you were describing were like a clay cup and clay things? Did they start getting, branching out and creating different kinds of relics, quote unquote?
Yeah, the scheme got much more elaborate. The estimation is there's maybe 3,000 pieces that we can sort of account for in various places. That's the estimate. And they moved on to more copper artifacts, spear points and swords and crowns and sandals. What's interesting, too, is that as they went, the critics would say, experts would say, well, these show modern tool marks. They show modern file marks. So what starts appearing in these relics but copper files?
Ah.
These clay pieces have the evidence of machine sawn boards. You know, they stuck the wet clay on a machine sawn board to dry, and you flip this thing over, and here's the evidence of, you know, a modern cut board. Well, that disappears. Then the point is that they're unfired clay, and if they were buried in the ground in Michigan, there's no way they'd last for thousands and thousands of years. And so they start to bake the clay pieces. When the LDS Church becomes interested in them, they start incorporating, you know, Mormon imagery into the pieces. And so it's just a really interesting, you know, set of phases of these things, if you will.
They're staying one step ahead of truth, if you will.
Well, they were trying.
Yes.
They were trying.
Now, who ultimately took this down? Who was involved in blowing this up?
Well, the 1907 reporting of Benscoter really kind of quashed it, although it sort of went on under Soper's promotion into the early 20s, and then it kind of died off, but it really hasn't stopped. And there are folks who are still interested and still believe they're real relics today.
Hmm. And you've got some of these relics, the Michigan relics. Do people come in looking to see them?
They do. In fact, I've got a couple folks lined up this summer and one I need to get back with who want to come and, and look at the relics, and we certainly can do that. We can't get all the pieces out. We have something upwards of 850 of them, 870, so it's not possible for us to get them all out at one time, really, but people can make an appointment and come and see them if they like.
It is kind of an interesting reminder that scam artists have certainly been around a long time, haven't they?
Yes.
What do you think is the overall lesson of the Michigan relics? What should we learn from this saga?
Well, I personally think it's more an issue of what people were interested in, what people knew about in the 1890s. You know, people were not aware of the achievements of Native peoples in Michigan, in America. You know, they said that the mounds were built by some other ancient civilization. So I think it's a lesson to me to really get in touch with the history and the archaeology that's yours in your local town and know what's going on there, rather than reading in some amazing story. The stories that really happened are more amazing than that.
Eric Perkins is an historian at the Michigan History Center. Thank you so much for sharing with us the story of the Soper relics, the Michigan relics. Eric, thanks so much.
Thank you.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. The price of wind is now cheaper than a new coal-burning plant, and Michigan is certainly getting on board with wind as a way to meet the state's renewable energy standard. There are 28 utility-scale wind farms now running or being developed. Most are in Huron County in the Thumb. Earlier this month, Huron County voters rejected two proposals that would have allowed more wind farms. So now what? Well, let's talk about that as we say hello to Skip Pruss, who is Michigan's chief energy officer in the Granholm administration, where he was also director of the Michigan Department of Energy, Labor, and Economic Growth. Skip, welcome to Stateside.
Well, thank you for having me.
It certainly seems as though people in the Thumb have had enough of wind turbines sprouting across their fields, and they said so by voting down those two proposals. How big of a setback is that for wind energy in Michigan?
Well, you know, I think it's becoming increasingly clear that the counties in the Thumb may have reached their limits in terms of additional wind projects. So there's something called turbine fatigue and turbine saturation, and I think we're at or near that point in Michigan's Thumb. So it's becoming certainly more challenging to site utility-scale wind projects, particularly in the Thumb, but We have lots of work to do in terms of meeting future goals. And not only that, I think there's a overall consensus that we need a lot more zero carbon energy resources. So that will entail siting additional wind farms and solar farms across the state and across the region. So we have our challenges before us.
When we use that term utility scale wind projects, how big would one be? How many wind turbines are we talking about?
You know, they can run from a dozen turbines, and there are no real exact limits here, mm-hmm. to, you know, 40 or 50 or maybe 60 or 70 turbines. What is happening now and what is happening on an accelerated basis is that we're moving to better and bigger technologies, so turbines that are capable of generating more electricity per unit, and so that should mean fewer turbines. But it also means larger turbines with longer blades.
And when you talk about turbine fatigue, anyone who has driven through the Thumb knows those folks they've lived with a lot of them. What is the day in, day out? What's it like living with turbines around you?
Well, I don't live there, mm-hmm. so I'm just a keen observer, and I'm involved in community engagement projects involving interaction with people who live with wind farms. So lots of experience. But I think there's no perfect form of energy, and largely people understand that. There are burdens associated with wind projects, utility-scale wind projects. Night lighting is one of them, the continuous blinking red lights at night. There can be noise issues. There can be what is called flicker, which is the reflection of the sun off the blades that occurs at certain angles at certain times. Mm. So those are, burdens associated with wind. What we try to do is educate communities so that they understand the various benefits and burdens that accompany all electric generation resources, whether it's natural gas plants, coal plants, nuclear plants, wind or solar farms, and equip them and inform them, give them the information so that they can make informed choices about energy. Because for the first time in our history, we really have choices about energy resources. We can choose to use low carbon or zero carbon resources that don't have any of the, you know, health and environmental impacts and impairments associated with the fossil fuel supplies that we use today.
We know DTE, which is the biggest electric utility in our state, has said they're going to cut their emissions by 80% by the year 2050, and doing that largely by switching from coal to wind and natural gas. So that means, you know, they're looking at wind. And if Huron County is out, where would they go? I mean, what areas of the state would be good for wind farms and would welcome them?
So in contrast to Huron County and the other counties in the Thumb, Tuscola and Sanilac, those counties are also challenging in terms of siting additional wind farms. We have Gratiot County, for instance, which has almost as many turbines as Huron County. The turbine density is really quite high. But in that community, there's very little opposition to wind. And indeed, county officials, local townships are inviting more wind projects into that area. So there are differences. When you go to the Thumb, there are competing economic interests, if you will. There's the tourist industry. There is high-value coastal property on Lake Huron. There's a diversity of economic interests in that region. In Gratiot County, in contrast, it's primarily agricultural. And wind is certainly a benefit, an economic benefit, and actually, I would argue, a benefit to agriculture for an agricultural county like Gratiot. So the other thing, in Gratiot County, there was a tremendous amount of work that was done in terms of communication with the community and education with the community prior to a single turbine ever being erected. And so the people of Gratiot County are just more amenable to wind projects for good reason.
So that template is something that needs to be used going forward to explore other counties.
Yeah. So the exciting thing is that with the improved technologies, so with turbines becoming more efficient and generating more electricity per unit and the economics improving, more areas of Michigan are opening up with these improved technologies that are agricultural. So large areas of central Michigan are candidates now for utility scale wind projects. And, you know, if farmers can have wind turbines on their project, it's really, and we hear this repeatedly from them, and actually the, you know, social science research bears this out, it's their most reliable income stream, right? Without having to any expenditures for seeds or herbicides or pesticides or grain drying or storing or hauling, you know, it's a set amount coming in every year reliably under a long-term contract.
There is a perception, Skip, that out there that wind isn't cost competitive when you compare it with other energy sources, that it only gets by with government support to kind of prop it up. Is that a fair perception?
It is a profoundly uninformed perception, let me say.
All right.
There are definitely subsidies for wind energy. It's about 2.3 cents per kilowatt hour. So it's a substantial subsidy. So subsidies, let me speak to that just for a moment, are, you know, they work. That's why they exist. They're particularly well-suited and actually designed theoretically for new technologies so that they can overcome the impediments to commercialization and gain market share. Under theory, subsidies then are supposed to end. So the current subsidies that exist for wind power and solar power are phasing out. They will be gone in less than 4 years, just over 3 years. The subsidies that exist for fossil fuels, and there's a whole array of subsidies for coal and for oil and gas development, those are embedded in our tax code. Oil and gas subsidies have been in existence for 100 years.
We don't even notice them, you're saying.
We don't. And more importantly, They're there forever unless Congress affirmatively acts to end those subsidies, unlike the subsidies for wind and solar, which up until recently had to be reauthorized every year, providing a really imperfect market signal for investors. So the long and short of it is wind and solar is subsidized now. The innovation is taking place. They are clearly on a timeline to be very competitive, to actually be the cheapest electric generation resource without subsidies in just a year or two, virtually in all energy markets in the country.
Wind technology, and really across the energy sector, has really changed rapidly over the past 10 years. From where you sit, what does energy production in Michigan look like in the year 2030?
Well, so hopefully, you know, we'll be generating a lot of our energy from wind and solar. The other thing that is happening now, which is phenomenal, that people are generally unaware of, is that, you know, we have new technologies for generating electricity. We have electric vehicles and the electrification of transportation on the horizon, which is very exciting. But we are also now capable of doing something that we've never done before, and that is manage energy. We can manage demand. And we can store energy because energy storage is becoming increasingly economical. And so what that means is that we have a lot of technology that allows us to balance energy supply with energy demand, including, you know, in your home, the smart thermostats and the technology that will come with your appliances will allow you to voluntarily participate in something called demand response, where your utility can just send a signal and power down your water heater or your refrigerator or, you know, at certain times with your consent. Mm. And in the aggregate, that will allow utilities to manage energy more efficiently. So it's a very exciting time.
What's at stake for Michigan and its economy, particularly in getting wind energy right?
So that's such a great question. Let me answer it this way. The market preference for electricity has changed dramatically just in the last 2 or 3 years. All the coolest, most dynamic corporations in the world, Apple, Facebook, Google, Amazon, Intel, Whole Foods, the list goes on and on and on, are companies who have declared that they have 100% zero carbon goals for their company. Google, at the end of June 2017, will power all of its data centers and all of its offices worldwide by zero carbon energy. They will meet their 100% goal. Interestingly, in Michigan, in the last few months, we've had General Motors declare a 100% clean energy goal for 360 manufacturing plants in 59 countries. We have Dow Chemical declaring a 100% clean energy goal. So here is the point. Businesses and corporations are expressing a clear preference for low-carbon energy resources, and they are demanding it. In fact, Google and 12 other companies sent a letter to our legislative leadership and our governor a while ago indicating that please don't repeal our renewable portfolio standards in Michigan because we make investment-based decisions on the availability of clean energy resources. So it's really important that Michigan have a robust future opportunity in terms of clean energy resources because businesses and corporations demand it. And you and I would submit, all things being equal, would prefer to have zero carbon electricity rather than carbon-rich electricity that affects our Great Lakes and has health and environmental impacts. We now know, we have scientists and academicians who have been calculating and aggregating the health impacts and the environmental impacts of the development of fossil fuels. If you are mining, extracting, processing, transporting, storing fossil fuels, and then burning the fossil fuels and then disposing of the waste, there's a lot of environmental impacts. There's a lot of health impacts. And we know how much they are. And, you know, for the United States alone, it's in the area of hundreds of billions of dollars per year in health and environmental impacts. That is a cost that ought to be included in the calculus when we compare the cost of wind and solar energy that doesn't have any of these environmental health impacts with electricity generated from fossil fuels.
Skip Press was the chief energy officer for the state of Michigan under the Granholm administration, where he also was director of the Michigan Department of Energy, Labor, and Economic Growth. Thank you so much for being with us, Skip. Great conversation.
Oh, thank you.
We turn now to Michigan Bookmark, our segment where notable Michigan writers review the works of other Michigan writers. Poet and writer Keith Taylor teaches in the undergraduate and graduate programs in creative writing at the University of Michigan. He directs the Bear River Writers Conference, and he's poetry editor for the Michigan Quarterly Review. He's published numerous poetry collections, and this year he published The Bird While. Commentator Kelly Forden says this just might be his best work yet.
Keith Taylor is a naturalist as well as a poet. Every summer, he spends several weeks at the University of Michigan's Biological Station. The poems in his newest collection contain a close, almost scientific attention to detail. This is a collection that delves into the truth of beauty, evanescence, and life through communion with the natural world. The title, The Bird While, refers to a term coined by Ralph Waldo Emerson, who asserted that the amount of space birds maintain between themselves and their observers is fixed and can be relied on, even measured, on a natural chronometer. The poems in this collection are mostly short and informed by Taylor's protracted surveillance. In interviews, he states that his fidelity to the natural world extends back to a childhood spent in rural Canada, and the fact that he is, as he puts it, only one generation removed from the farm. In the long poem Mapping the River, Taylor recreates the sensation of floating down a river, beginning with the headwaters, seeping out between horizons of gravel and clay, where the water is just the suggestion of river, and continuing, in his words, to the perfect lonely moments when we want only to watch the fall of water, to feel the spray, to hear, thankfully, only the dam's white noise. The poem ends at Dead Man's Point, where, quote, the dead would hang up in the rushes or on the gray-brown log snags, often disappearing under snow and ice, their bones scattered and gone by breakup. Taylor's childhood home was remote, and one surmises from several poems here that even with the lure of the wilderness, he was restless as a teenager. The collection contains two poems about running away from home, one of which, Banff, Running Away, offers this astute rumination about youth. I was young enough to believe that when moments felt significant, they probably were. I saw sacraments everywhere. More than any other creature in this collection, Taylor finds the otherness of birds fascinating, because, as he says, they are mysterious, allowing only glimpses of their lives, disappearing for long periods and then returning of their own accord. Taylor cuts a gentle path through these poems, perhaps most strikingly in the last one, Acolytes of the Birdwhile. We have lingered in that space granted by a woodpecker before it disappears on the far side of a dying elm. We have held our collective breath as a warbler, redstart, prothonotary, or golden-winged brushes across our shoulders. We have prayed to avian gods we don't believe in, that piping plovers may avoid windows, cats, and windmills, will survive habitat loss, climate change, and oil spills, to allow us that one immeasurable moment at sunset when we count their glowing bills among our fragile, vanishing gifts. What a gift to spend some time with Keith Taylor in The Birdwhile.
Kelly Forden is a poet and fiction writer. Her collection of linked stories, Garden for the Blind, was an Indie Fab finalist, an Ippy Bronze medalist, a Midwest Book Award finalist, and a 2015 Michigan Notable Book. Today's Stateside was directed by Mike Blank. Our executive producer is Joe Lindstroff. Contributors are Allie Billings, Mercedes Mejia, Lindsay Scullin, Josh Hakala, and Nick Wallace. Stateside's a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan.
I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.